Good evening. How's everybody doing tonight? I hope well. I love the fact that you came back tonight. Thank you very much. I want to say, to start out, that I love my wife. I love my kids. In a different sense, I really love fly fishing. I also have come to love and enjoy woodworking to a certain extent. I love the fact that I made my daughter and her husband their kitchen table. I did, and I loved it. I also love when I discovered the last Reese's peanut butter cup in the refrigerator that I thought was not there, but indeed was there. I love that. And I like the way that Mel B on America's Got Talent says love. She kind of says, I love it. I told my wife I was going to put that in somehow, and I did. So to a certain extent, you're looking at this title slide that says Keystone Everest in Love, and you're trying to figure out, Mark, where are you going with this? What is really the purpose and intent of your lesson? Because you started out kind of talking about the things that you love, and I did. But it's not really a lesson about the different types of love, if you will. It really is a lesson, though, on love. We will discover really the genesis of that and the nature of that as we continue to move along. However, in the beginning, I thought it might be a little appropriate to go through some architectural history. Now you're really going, Mark, where are you going with this? Architectural history as it relates to love. How do you do that? Trust me. So this first one that you see up on the screen is called the Pont de Garde. It is a Roman aqueduct that was built in the first century AD. You can see its grandeur. It obviously is still standing in spite of wars, time, the ravages of the environment, weather is still there. Okay? Pont de Garde. If you didn't know that that existed, now you do. And this one I put in there simply because I like to say Arc de Triomphe. That's what I like to say, so I put it in there. Nonetheless, it does represent, and you'll see it soon, a point that I want to make. It was built literally, actually, in 1836. Kind of thought it was a little older than that, but no. This is to commemorate the Napoleonic Wars that actually did take place at the beginning of the 1800s. It's when it was commissioned, but it was completed in 1836. There was a lot of things that happened in between. There was a halt on it, so it didn't get to be built until that time. Next, we have the Arc de Severus, yet another very ancient arc structure. 2003 AD, which commemorates the Parthian victories of Emperor Severus of Rome. Again, you'll begin to notice that there is a bit of a theme in all of these, and that theme is, it is an arch. And the last one is the Arc de Janus, built in the 4th century AD. It's a Roman crossroads landmark, a major thoroughfare at this particular crossroads. And so the Romans thought that it would be good to put some kind of a landmark there because the Romans liked to build things. And they did a good job at building those things. And so this next slide, you'll see every one of those before you on the screen. What I want you to do is I want you to kind of talk to yourself, and I want you to pick out something that really stands out to you even amongst these architecturally arch structures. Okay? I want you to just look at them for a short second. I want you to grasp onto what it is that you key into, and then I want you to hold on to that. Okay? And then I want to ask you, was it that? How many of you were looking at that? Actually, one person, Kathy, and I knew it would be Kathy. It does not surprise me that Kathy would kind of focus in on that, right? It's the keystone. We've all heard that term before, architecturally and with the physics bent on it, the keystone, rather valuable. We'll see here later where those keystones are. But again, There are keystones in most arch structures, masonry structures. There are keystones or capstones, if you will. Now, the purpose of the keystone, it's a wedge-shaped stone, kind of a piece at the apex of the masonry arch. It is the final piece placed during construction that locks all of the stones into position, allowing the arch to bear weight. The keystone is the most important stone in the arch bridge, and without the keystone, the arch would literally collapse. The keystone holds the arch together. That's what it does. And so you can begin to see that it's a rather important architectural piece when we are talking about arch structures, right? So again, Mark, where are you going with this? Why are we in an architectural class? We did not sign up for this. We'll get there, trust me. So you can see here on the screen where those keystones are located. And so what's going to happen from now on is every time that you see an arch structure, what are you going to look for? Yeah, you're going to look for the keystone, right? Because I've implanted that into your brain. And that's kind of how that works. But this can often become lost within the structure due to how large the other aspects of the structure are. We don't necessarily notice the small things about those structures. And when I asked the question, how many of you saw the keystone, only one of you was at least willing to raise your hand and to suggest that that's not what you were looking at. But it is the most important piece, and in all of those structures, had that stone not been placed there, those structures would not have stood. So the keystone, very important. However, we sometimes tend to kind of forget about the keystone and the importance of it because the structure is so very large. So for me, this really kind of rooted itself out to be a perfect example of love for two reasons. So we as Christians sometimes lose sight or neglect to see or practice the love as Christ would have us to love. We sometimes kind of lose sight of that. A lot of things are going on. Maybe there's more rule type things that we have to focus on. Who knows what the case may be, but sometimes we just lose focus regarding love. And sometimes we don't see it. Sometimes we don't practice it. On the other hand, love is the keystone to being a Christian. Colossians 3, 12 through 14. Therefore, as the elect of God, holy and beloved, put on tender mercies, kindness, humility, meekness, long-suffering, bearing with one another and forgiving one another. If anyone has a complaint against another, even as Christ forgave you, you also must do. But above all these things, put on love, which is the bond of perfection. The bond of perfection. The keystone. That's what holds everything together. So, time for some honest questions to all of us. Not just to you, but to me as well. And I do mean that. I'm very serious when I say time for honest questions. Right? So, here's the question. On a scale from 1 to 10, 10 being the very greatest, 1 being the very not greatest, how would you rate yourself as far as being a loving Christian? How would you rate yourself? Think about that for a moment. In your mind, in your heart, how would you rate yourself on a scale from 1 to 10 as far as being a loving Christian? Would you say maybe a 6 or a 7, or be so bold as to say maybe a 9, maybe even a 10? Maybe? How about this? Basically, I'm a loving person, but, and maybe you finish that sentence with, but I could do better at loving. Or maybe you finish it like this. Basically, I am a loving person, but, you know, so-and-so could be a lot more loving. He could be a whole lot more loving than me, because I'm basically a loving person. Sometimes we finish those sentences like that. In John chapter 13, verses 33 through 35, and this will be the crux of where I want to go tonight, Jesus is speaking to his apostles, and he says to them, "Little children, I shall be with you a little while longer, and you will seek me. And as I said to the Jews, where I am going, you cannot come. And so now I say to you, a new commandment," verse 34, very important, "a new commandment I give to you, that you love one another as I have loved you, that you also love one another. By this all will know that you are my disciples, if you love one another." Imagine having that conversation and hearing that from Jesus as one of his apostles. So there's some fine print here. And as they say, it's always important to read the fine print. You know you've been burnt before when you haven't read the fine print. You should have read the fine print. Here the fine print is fairly bold, but I call it the fine print. A new covenant, verse 34, a new commandment I give to you, that you love one another, underlined here, as I have loved you, you also love one another. As I have loved you, that you also love one another. As I have loved you, you also love one another. As I have loved you. As Jesus saying, as I have loved you, you do also love one another. When you say it over and over, and then you are crystal clear on who said that, in this case, Jesus, and you say that over and over, that really bumps that commandment up to more of like a Mount Everest type of a command, does it not? I mean, that's huge. I mean, think about it. Just say it over and over to yourself. And when I was putting together this lesson, I said it over and over to myself, and it stopped me in my tracks. I was probably that person who said, you know, basically I'm a pretty loving person. I could probably do better. And no doubt there were times when I said, you know, basically, I am a loving person, but so-and-so should be more loving. I'm pretty sure I was that guy. As I have loved you, that you also love one another. As I said, that's kind of a Mount Everest command. Mount Everest. Everybody familiar with Mount Everest? Anybody in this room climb Mount Everest? For some reason, I was going to kind of look over at Kathy again, because she'd probably raise her hand and go, yeah, I climbed it. Okay, nobody in this room has climbed Mount Everest. I get it. I don't blame you. It is, arguably, the tallest vertical mountain in the world at 29,029 feet. That's over 5 miles up. That's a lot. I get winded just climbing up Pisgah sometimes. And that's pretty easy. This is Mount Everest, right? We know that people have climbed Mount Everest. But very few really have summited Mount Everest. Very many, and I mean a very many, have died trying to summit Mount Everest. But in no case does anybody live up there. Not at the top. In no case does anybody live there continually. In like fashion, we may, on rare occasions, succeed in loving others as Christ loved us, but none of us live there continually as Christ did. Again, we may, on rare occasions, succeed in loving others as Christ loved us, but none of us live there continuously. So now we begin to kind of get down into really the meat of this lesson tonight as far as Christ's love and what it is about. Jesus commands us to love one another as he loved us. And the key, or keystone, if you will, of his command is understanding how Jesus loved us. John 13:34, that verse that I read over and over, really does reveal four aspects of his love. Jesus' love was a costly love. It was a caring love. It was a conspicuous love. And so much, it was a committed love. And I want to take us through tonight those aspects of Jesus' love on the premise of asking ourselves to rate our scales, or ourselves on a scale from 1 to 10 on how well we love one another as Jesus loved us. I did it. I did the same thing. And I will tell you right now that I was not a 6 or a 7, an 8, a 9, or a 10. In fact, humbly speaking and embarrassingly so, it's probably well below 5. That's okay. Because that's why God gave us His Word. And that's why He gave us Jesus as the example to show us how to love as He loved us. And so that's what we will do this evening. John 13:31-32. So when He had gone out, Jesus said, "Now the Son of Man is glorified, and God is glorified in Him. If God is glorified in Him, God will also glorify Himself and glorify Him immediately." Now this particular passage refers back to John 12:23, where Jesus was answering some questions and speaking to the Jews at that time. And in verse 23 of John 12, He said, "But Jesus answered them, saying, 'The hour has come that the Son of Man should be glorified.'" Now ultimately what this did in the context of those passages is it showed that soon Jesus was going to be sacrificed. Jesus was going to hang on that cross, and He was going to suffer, and He was going to die. That is what He was saying in the context. Costly. So there were a number of different pictures that, of course, you can find on the internet of Jesus hanging on the cross. Some of them are more artist rendition in terms of pen and paper or pencil and paper. Others are paintings. Others are reenactments of people who literally are hanging from a cross. Some of them are more gruesome than others. But the point is made by a picture of Jesus on the cross. Answers the question, well, why the cross? Why was that? Remember, it was to glorify the Son and the Father at the same time. But at the same time, it was the epitome or perfect example of humiliation. No greater punishment was there at the time than to be crucified, to be stripped naked, flogged, beaten, humiliated, spat upon, and then hammered to a wooden cross and hung to where you slowly suffered and then died. That was the worst humiliation that one could possibly imagine. It's a costly love. We know in John 3:16, the passage very familiar to us, "For God so loved the world that He gave His only begotten Son, that whomever believes in Him should not perish, but should have everlasting life." Galatians 2:20, "I have been crucified with Christ. It is no longer I who live, but Christ lives in me. And the life which I now live in Him, in the flesh, I live by faith in the Son of God, who loved me and gave Himself for me." Ephesians 5:2, "And walk in love, as Christ also loved us, giving Himself for us, an offering and a sacrifice to God for a sweet-smelling aroma." 1 John 3:16, "By this we know love, because He laid down His life for us, and we also ought to lay down our lives for the brethren." Hebrews 12 and verse 2 states that it was the joy that was set before Christ that Jesus endured the cross. I want to read to you, not in its ultimate entirety, but I do want to read to you Matthew 26, verses 36 through 34. And as you know, this is the account of Jesus praying in the Garden of Gethsemane. Then Jesus went with them to a place called Gethsemane, and he said to the disciples, "Sit here while I go over there and pray." And taking with him Peter and the two sons of Zebedee, he began to be sorrowful and troubled. And then he said to them, "My soul is very sorrowful, even to death. Remain here and watch with me." And going a little further, he fell on his face, praying, saying, "My Father, if it be possible, let this cup pass from me. Nevertheless, not as I will, but as you will." And he came to the disciples and found them sleeping, and he said to Peter, "So could you not watch with me 1 hour? Watch and pray that you may not enter into temptation. The spirit indeed is willing, but the flesh is weak." And again, the second time, he went away and prayed, "My Father, if this cannot pass unless I drink it, your will be done." And again he came and found them sleeping, for their eyes were heavy. And so leaving them again, he went away and prayed for the third time, saying the words again. And still, Jesus went to the cross. It was costly. His love was costly. His love was caring love. 1 John 13 and verse 33, he says, "Little children, I shall be with you a while longer. You will seek me, and as I said to the Jews, where I am going, you cannot come. And so I say to you." We see Jesus, his very tender, caring nature in two different ways in this particular passage. First, he speaks and uses the term little children. Now, in this particular case, it is the only use of that term in the Gospels. And Jesus refers to them as his little children. I remember, you know, very clearly when I would have to leave for work and I would have to leave my wife and my girls, my little girls. And I would see them and they would run up and hug me and their heads would reach my kneecaps and they were little. They were my little girls. And I referred to them as that. And secondarily, Peter, he does this. He carefully explains to them what's about to happen. Just as I did when I had to leave. When my girls would come and run up to me and say, "Daddy, where are you going? Where are you going?" And with everything I had to hold back the tears, I had to explain to them that I had to go away for work, but that I would be gone for just a short time, but that I would be coming back, and that they would see me, and that I would bring them prizes. And they were my little girls. But I wanted them to know. And that's exactly what Jesus did with his disciples. John 14, verses 1 through 3. "Let not your heart be troubled. You believe in God, believe also in me. In my Father's house are many mansions, and if it were not so, I would have told you. I go to prepare a place for you, and if I go and prepare a place for you, I will come again and receive you to myself, that where I am, there you may be also." And so we see the tenderness of Jesus' love with his disciples, saying to them, "You can't come with me right now. But don't worry. Soon you will be with me. Don't worry." His love was caring. He had a conspicuous love. John 13 to verse 35, "By this all will know that you are my disciples. That is, if you have love for one another. People will know that you're my disciples if you have love for one another. It's nice to think about the fact that you love somebody, right? As I mentioned, I love my wife. I love my wife. But if the only thing that I did was think that, and I didn't demonstrate that, or at the very least say that, how would she know that I loved her? I'm thinking it. Therefore, it's got to be true, and it is true. But I'm thinking it. By this, all will know that you are my disciples. If you have love for one another, what does that mean? Notice 1 John 3, verses 10 through 14. In this, the children of God and the children of the devil are manifest. Whomever does not practice righteousness is not of God. Nor is he who does not love his brother. For this is the message that you heard from the beginning, that we should love one another. Not as Cain, who was of the wicked one and murdered his brother. And why did he murder him? Because his works were evil and his brother's righteous. Do not marvel, my brethren, if the world hates you. We know that we have passed from death to life because we love brethren. He who does not love his brother abides in death. It's a conspicuous love. It is one that we must show and demonstrate as Christ did. That it is seen. Not just in our hearts. And really not just with what we say, but in our actions. Christ's love was a very committed love, as we can certainly understand. John 13, verses 36 and 38. Simon Peter said to him, Lord, where are you going? And Jesus answered him, where I am going, you cannot follow me now, but you will follow me afterward. Peter said to him, Lord, why can I not follow you now? I will lay down my life for your sake. And Jesus answered, will you lay down your life for my sake? Most assuredly, I say to you, the rooster shall not crow until you have denied me three times. This really doesn't represent the commitment of Christ. Mark, help me with this. We've all had good lessons on what happened to Peter. We all have heard lessons in terms of, okay, Peter's weakness. What happened with that? Maybe it wasn't so much of Peter's recognizing his weaknesses, but maybe it was him trusting in his fallible loyalty to Christ and not trusting Christ. And that's a very different lesson. This is not about Peter to Jesus. This is about Jesus' commitment, his committed love to Peter, in spite of Peter and to the rest of the apostles who abandoned him. This is what that is about. And it is that commitment to Peter and the others that we are talking about. In Matthew chapter 26, through the entirety of that, specifically in verse 31, 35, and 36, is where we see the failure of those apostles with their master, with Jesus. We see that. They abandoned him. In John 13, in verse 1, Jesus showed his love for them to the end. Now, before the feast of the Passover, when Jesus knew that his hour had come, that he should depart from this world to the Father, having loved his own who were in the world, he loved them to the end. Christ, I will lay down my life for you. How many times have we said that? You can never catch me. I promise, I give you, never going to happen. It happens all the time. It certainly happened with Peter. Christ knew that Peter was going to do that. He knew that. But yet he still loved them to the end. Jesus loved them. So it all together, that is purpose. I did say it like that. It all together. It just seems fitting. I didn't forget a word. That's the way that I wanted it. So the costliness of love means that we have to sacrifice our selfishness for others. Rate yourself on a scale from 1 to 10. The caring aspect of love means that we should never be calloused or rude. Rate yourself on a scale from 1 to 10. The conspicuous part of love means that it doesn't just consist of nice thoughts, but our visible love actions. Rate yourself on a scale from 1 to 10. Lastly, a commitment of love is that we deeply desire to see the other person become more like Christ. Above ourselves and what our needs may be, losing our selfishness, we deeply desire to see the other person, whoever that other person is. We certainly want to be with Christ, no doubt there. But that's the love, the committed love, is that we deeply desire the other person to want to have and that relationship and be more like Christ. 1 Corinthians 13, verses 4 through 7. And keystone. As we've learned what the keystone is. Love suffers long and is kind. Love, it doesn't envy. Love does not parade itself. It's not puffed up. Does not behave rudely. Does not seek its own. Is not provoked. Thinks no evil. Does not rejoice in iniquity. But rejoices in the truth. Bears all things. Believes all things, hopes all things, and endures all things. That is love. How do I rate myself on a scale from 1 to 10 when it comes to showing the love that Christ commands me to have? Maybe that's a hard question to answer. But the good news is that we have His example. And we can be better at loving one another as Christ loved us. We may not be able to live continuously at the top of Everest, but the more that we try to summit it, the more that we do that, the more our lungs get used to the low altitude, the high altitude, I should say, and the low oxygen. The more that we do that, we get better at doing that. To where we might be able to live more frequently, closer to the top. And one day we can actually hold Jesus' hand, who is at the top. So tonight, this lesson was hopefully a reminder to us in terms of what does it really mean to love? And to always self-reflect on where you are, where I am, when it comes to that commandment of love. Am I really those four ways described in verse 34? Do I do that? Should I be better at doing that? For me, the answer is yes. Absolutely is. Tonight is a night where if you are not a Christian, and if you want to know more about Christ's love, if you need to know more about the love of Christ, tonight is for you. If you are not a Christian and you are in that position, tonight is for you. That Christ looks at you and sees you and loves you. And He asks you, why are you waiting? Come and let me love you, He says.
be baptized, wash away your sins to the fullness and newness of life. And this night is for you. If you are here and you are a Christian, then maybe you are contemplating your love, or as Ron presented to us this morning, your growth. Are you concerned about making it to the harbor? If you are, this night is for you. In either case, this night is for you, and we would ask that you come forward if you so desire, as we all stand and say all stand and say all stand.